Welcome to episode 457 of That Triathlon Show, the podcast presented by scientifictriathlon.com. My name is Michael Eriksson, and today I interview Michele Jones. Michele is an Olympic silver medalist from the Sydney Games in 2000. She's a two-time ITU world champion and the Ironman world champion from 2006. I'll let her introduce herself in more detail, but first, if this is your first time here or you just missed our last episode, a reminder that, well, we have lots of episodes in the back catalog, but in the last episode in particular, Melindy Elmore was on. She is a professional runner and a former professional triathlete, and we discussed her marathon training, how she manages to perform and continue to improve into her 40s and as a mother, her short but successful professional triathlon career, how she trained to achieve all of the podiums she did achieve in a short amount of time, some double threshold protocols, and lots more. So go and give it a listen after this one if you're interested and want to just get more content about endurance training and endurance sports. Now, just before we get into the interview, big thanks to our sponsors, Precision Fuel and Hydration. They create carbohydrate products like gels, drink mix, and shoes that are effective, practical, and tasty. And of course, they also make electrolyte products in different strengths, so you can choose one that best matches your sweat sodium concentration. Their products make it easy for you to execute your nutrition hydration plan in both training and racing, as they are tasty, they have practical packaging, and use simple round numbers, so you don't have to do mental math when redlining in a race. They have a free fuel and hydration planner, free consultations with sports scientists, a massive database of case studies, and lots of in-depth and well-researched articles that will give you everything from the basics to the finer nuances of nutrition and hydration. And as a TTS listener, you can get 15% off your first order of 2025 by using the code TTS25 on precisionfuelandhydration.com. Now, without any further ado, let's get into the interview with Michele Jones. Welcome to That Triathlon Show, Michele. How are you doing?
Great, thank you. I'm going to fix your pronunciation on my name, though, because it's Michele.
Michele. I'm really sorry.
I don't blame you. I just say my parents were very bad spellers.
Well, thank you for correcting me.
That's okay, but names are tricky. I wish people had easier names sometimes. So I totally get it. It's like, I blame my parents. Like, give me an unusual name and then don't even spell it the way that it should be spelled.
With that, can you tell us a bit more about yourself? Maybe there's something else that your parents forced you to do, like doing triathlon. I don't know. But tell us a bit more about your background in the sport and how you got into triathlon in the first place and then into coaching as well.
Yeah, so, you know, I started racing back in 1988, and it was basically my high school run coach suggested I do triathlon, and I'm very happy he pushed me in that direction. And, you know, when I was a kid, it's like I always liked to play different sports, and my talent identification was actually race walking. So those people in Europe know what race walking is. The rest of the world sometimes doesn't know what race walking is, but yeah, but that wasn't my passion. You know, I used to run like the 3,000 meter on the track. I was state cross country champion. My real background, though, is horse riding. I grew up horse riding competitively. So that was sort of my passion. And then I sort of gave that up to start doing triathlon and basically put myself through college and paid for that by doing like little short races here and there. All my friends were very jealous that I could make couple of hundred dollars here, couple of hundred dollars there for an hour of work, basically. There was just something about triathlon that like I just loved. I love the fact that, and I say this today, you know, just when you get sick of swimming, you get to ride your bike. And just when you get sick of biking, you get to run. I competed at my first ITU World Championship back in 1990. And then, of course, it progressed to winning two ITU World Championships in 92 and 93. And then, of course, the Olympics. I got to experience the first ever Olympics, and it was in my home country of Australia and in Sydney. Fantastic backdrop. So to walk away with the silver medal, absolutely proud of my performance on that day. And then, of course, didn't quite get to do the Olympics again, and that pushed me towards Ironman, and I swore I would never ever do an Ironman. And I did that I did my first Ironman in 2004, in Kona in 2005. Wasn't perfect prep, broke my hip leading into that, but managed still to get second. Natasha Badman passed me with 10 kilometers to go and turned around and won the Ironman World Championships in 2006. And at that point, I was the oldest first-time winner at age 36 to have won the Ironman. And then that led me to another opportunity where I got to do the Paralympics, and I guided Katie Kelly in the first ever triathlon for para, and we walked away with the gold medal, and definitely probably the highlight of my career. And then, you know, I started racing some age group races, always been asked, can you coach me? Can you coach me? So during that course of time as a professional, there was times that I would help athletes. I really tried to mentor a number of athletes, Chris McCormick, Craig Alexander, just to name a few. And, you know, to this stage now, my profession has gone from being a professional athlete to being a professional coach.
The time that you went to the Paralympics and won the gold as a guide, what year was that?
That was in Rio. So that was Rio.
It was 10 years. That's what I had in mind. Like, I wasn't quite sure. That's why I'm asking you, because at that point you would have been 46 years old. Is that right then? So.
Yeah, 46, 47. So, yeah, like, I mean, that's basically like the short reel of my career and how I got into coaching. And yeah, it's like, I mean, I have a degree in teaching, so that is definitely an extent. Coaching is teaching. So that's definitely an extension of that. If you had to ask me if I would be coaching as a profession after I finished triathlon, I'm not sure I would have said coaching, but like, I absolutely love it. So passionate, love seeing my athletes, you know, set goals and achieve them.
Yeah, I didn't know that you had that background, the degree in teaching, I mean, and that gives us a whole new category of questions that maybe we'll get to at some point, because I'm quite fascinated by how you can leverage that expertise in coaching, which I'm sure you can, and I'm keen to ask a bit more about that. But before that, of all the things you mentioned in your own athletic career, can you point out, or can you choose one thing that was the best thing? Is it that Paralympic gold, or what would you say?
Definitely that Paralympic gold is a highlight, right? Getting an opportunity to like help somebody else, you know, especially when, you know, triathlon is such an individualized sport. And then to get that opportunity to turn it around and help somebody else. But, you know, it's like, I can pick, like, there's probably like several that I can, you know, winning my first world championship, like absolutely amazing experience. Going to the Olympics, like the crowd was absolutely amazing. When we were warming up, the Australians were just going nuts. It was like they were already cheering for us when we were warming up, and I'd never experienced that. And to be on the start line and look up in the stands and see my friends and family, and my twin sister was crying, and it was like I'm trying to like keep it together. I'm like, oh my God, this is the biggest race I've ever done in my entire career. And it was so emotional. And then, you know, saying that I would never do something, and then, you know, I think having the guts to do it, and that was to do an Ironman. But, you know, I was smart. I hired the best coach that I thought would help me get across that finish line, and that was Paula Newby-Fraser, 8-time world champion. So I definitely, like, knew what I wanted to achieve. I knew I had a small window. So to be able to win the Ironman World Championship at age 36, you know, it was my second ever Ironman. So pretty proud of that. And of course, you know, we've already talked about Rio, just absolutely amazing to see how much our sport's grown, not just in like able-bodied sport, but also in para triathlon. You know, I look back on all the moments that triathlon has given me, but has also given a lot of other people. I think our sport is so special in that way.
And are you still racing a bit of age group racing to this day?
Yes, I actually raced in Taupo in New Zealand at the 70.3 championships in December. And happy to say I won my age group in the 55 to 59. And, you know, it's always interesting because, you know, there's that big debate, should ex-professionals race against like age groupers? And I'm like, I'm just happy that I still have the passion to want to get on a start line.
Yeah, I mean, I 100% agree with that. I think it's I think it's impressive to have the passion because it's not that many people, very few in fact, that do. It's such a difficult sport, such a time-consuming sport that for a lot of people, when they do it as their profession, when that career is over, then people generally still tend to love to exercise and be moving, but maybe not so much doing triathlon, which is a bit of an extreme sport just in the demands that it plays on you. So I'm hugely impressed by the fact that you have that passion still in you.
Yeah, and it, you know, the hard thing is like everyone thinks that it comes easy to you too. Like, oh, you're a professional, you're just going to walk away with the win, but you know, you still have to do the training. And I can't do the sort of load that like some of my athletes can because like, you know, I talk a lot about triathlon age and I sort of relate it to dog years. It's like the number of years you've been doing triathlon times 7 because there is an impact that if you've been doing a sport for a long time, you know, there is a lot of wear and tear on you physically and mentally. And it's just like, for me, it's like, if I can find my why, and if I can feel that I'm motivated to do it, that I'm very selective, like when I push myself, because I don't want to burn myself out. So I know over the years, if I like, you know, I set a goal each year and I have these little stepping stones that I use, just like when I'm coaching my athletes to get myself to that start line. And, you know, I do have the luxury of saying, no, I don't want to do it, or yes, I want to do it. And I think that's important as well, because it's got to be fun. And I think that's an important message for anyone, whether you're a professional or you're an age grouper, no matter what, there has to be an element of fun. Otherwise, you won't enjoy it and you won't have longevity.
Yeah, yeah. Well, that's definitely a great example that you're setting in that regard.
Thank you.
I want to ask a bit more about your transition into coaching. So you said that you had started to have friends and other people asking you about that. So was that something that happened over kind of gradually and organically over time, or was there a point when you were like, okay, I'm going to start coaching all of these friends, and it suddenly was what you were doing and what you were almost identifying as a coach? How did that happen?
I think it, like, the transition was more like it was a more of a mentoring type of thing, like, you know, trying to set other athletes up for success. Like I talked a little bit about Chris McCormick and Craig Alexander. It's like, you know, just not just setting them up to succeed on the race course, but to set them up to succeed as professional athletes. And, you know, it's like the sport has grown so much, and it's always nice to see how much more money now these athletes make, which I think that's a big, huge step for our sport as they continually push the boundaries of what's possible physically, that they are getting rewarded. Although I still believe we're a very underpaid sport, it's nice to see they are getting rewarded. So it sort of started as that, you know, you need to come and do this, or you should do this. Why aren't you doing this? And then it sort of evolved, like, as I said, that, you know, I had other athletes who wanted to start coaching me. And I don't really know at that point where it became, okay, I am a professional coach, or it was just, you know, it wasn't like a standout moment. It was just, you know, people just kept asking me. And of course, the last couple of years, it's definitely being more formalized. I do coaching because I absolutely love it, and I want to give back that knowledge that I've learned over the years. And, you know, it comes back to that teaching degree. You know, I've always wanted to be in education, and coaching is education. And, you know, my athletes motivate me sometimes more than I motivate them. So, you know, seeing them succeed. And, you know, I think the one thing is, like, I think I have a really good understanding of what it takes. You know, I always tell my athletes, I'm never going to give you a session that I wouldn't do myself personally. You know, some people will say, oh, athletes don't always make good coaches. But I That's true for sure. There's always, you know, it's like anything. There's good coaches and bad coaches. And, you know, I think it really comes down on, you know, what are the cornerstones of your coaching style? And I really believe that I have an empathy for what the athletes are going through. And I know that the secret is consistency. I think that's, you know, consistency. I sort of always use the word consistency over perfection, because if you can be consistent for a long period of time, then you are more likely to succeed and reach your goals, because, you know, you're less injured, you don't get sick, and, you know, you're not going to get those times where, you know, it's so frustrating when you get injured as an athlete. So I try to, like, be empathetic. I try to be smart. I'm not a big, like, you have to go long and hard all the time. And I try to teach my athletes, and it's my coaching style too. You've got to be adaptable. You know, every athlete that you have, there's a puzzle that you've got to put together. Sometimes that puzzle is super easy, and sometimes that puzzle is like really, really difficult. And I think that challenge and that communication piece, that you build that trust and that relationship, because it's a two-way street. If your athlete isn't communicating what they're doing, it's like, as a coach, it's really hard to keep that progression going. At the start, yeah, progression's easy, but you have these athletes long-term, it's, you know, progression is so important. And I believe a good coach should teach an athlete how to coach themselves.
Do you have an example of when that puzzle was really difficult with some athlete, and then kind of how you solved that or overcame that challenge?
Yeah, you know, it's as simple as, like, sometimes, as I said, it's as simple as like having a conversation, and it's like you see what's happening with the numbers and you're like, why aren't they performing the way they should be? And, you know, I sort of break sometimes athletes down into two categories. They're champion racers or they're champion trainers. And sometimes when I'm seeing the numbers on paper and then I'm not seeing the results, there's two things I ask myself, and like I've had this happen several times. It's like, am I providing them with the right workouts based on what their weaknesses and strengths are? Or is it the other side of training, that mental aspect? Is there something that I'm missing that we're not working on mentally to get them to have that standout performance? And, you know, I had this one athlete that was putting so much pressure on themselves. Here's the example. They were putting so much pressure on themselves for the Olympics, and they had this emotional baggage that they were carrying because they promised their mum, who had passed away, that for one, they would make it to the Olympics. And that emotional baggage is fatiguing. And I think a lot of athletes don't understand sometimes the emotion of like racing for that purpose, rather than ultimately you've got to race for yourself. And so just having that conversation, and like, you know, and it's a physical response that emotion has. This athlete like would get into a race and feel, just this one particular race, would feel emotionally drained. And when we had a chat about it, it was that emotional baggage that she kept carrying. And sort of once she got rid of it, her performance then skyrocketed.
Yeah. Yeah. I think that pressure, whether self-imposed or external pressure, that's for sure something that is very underestimated in how much it can impact you and your performance. Yeah. And that example is a pretty difficult situation. I mean, I think that it's probably not the thing to promise your dying mom, because your mom would love you no matter what, I'm sure. And it's not about getting to the Olympics or not, but having done that, then I'm sure that it's a very difficult thing to not have feel that pressure every day, to having to make it to the Olympics and then doing well there.
Yeah, and some athletes respond to that type of stimulus, right? They can turn it around. Like I had another athlete who's a close friend, and her brother had passed away, and she was just racing at Short Course Worlds recently, and she had put his name on his top tube, her top tube, thinking that that would really inspire her, but it did it the other way. She got very, very emotional about it. So, you know, it's it's tricky because on one hand, you think that it's going to be performance enhancing, but on the other hand, not everyone responds the same way. And that's where that individualized approach and then really like digging deep into why an athlete isn't performing the way they should isn't always about the numbers. And that's why that communication piece is like, for me, like so important.
Yeah. You mentioned a bit earlier the question about strengths and weaknesses, training strengths and weaknesses, or giving the right sessions for improving strengths and weaknesses. How do you view that? Do you have which do you work on when, or what is your philosophy around improving strengths versus weaknesses, or strengths and weaknesses rather?
I love this question because I think I answer this probably a little bit opposite sometimes than other coaches. I'm like, always work on your strengths, right? Because when you're good at something, you can still be good at that and improve on it. Sometimes, like to put it bluntly, when you suck, sometimes you're always going to suck at something, right? So it's evaluating like how much you suck at something is sort of a little bit of my philosophy as well, right? If you're really good at something, hey, let's see if we can improve that. If you really suck at that, how much time and energy are we going to spend? And maybe it's not as big as somebody thinks the reward's going to be. So in terms of that, then, you know, you got to break down the skill level into like swimming, like efficiency always in swimming, right? Good technique. But, you know, there's a limit to sometimes an athlete's efficiency based on, you know, are they tight in the thoracic? You know, do they have ankles that, you know, that need like more flexibility to be able to keep those feet a little bit straighter and, you know, rotate those toes in a little bit? So it's like, for me, like efficiency, what is the best efficiency based on the limitations that each athlete has for swimming? Because, you know, we can all say, you know, practice, 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 but, you know, if you're not working on those little skills, and, you know, maybe your thoracic mobility is going to get a little bit better, and maybe it's not going to get significantly better, but if we can make you as efficient as possible in the swim, I think that's important. Because, you know, we want swimmers to feel like it's easy, because the best swimmers in the world make it look easy, right? And the effort level, like when I'm swimming fast, it feels easy. And try to relay that to the athletes that, you know what, get out of the mentality that you've got to go hard all the time. Spend some time on that technique. I think in biking, for me, I think one of the cornerstones of my coaching is like starting with a good bike fit. You know, invest in yourself. I think that's really important. That's so key in maximizing your performance. Yes, you need the strength. You need the endurance. You need all the other aspects of putting that puzzle together. But a good bike fit is a game changer, right? Because if you can't hold your position, you're not going to be able to hold that power. Your numbers are going to go down based on the fact that, you know, doesn't matter how strong you are in the world, if you can't hold that aerodynamic position and still be able to run off the bike, it's sort of like a wasted effort. So I really believe that, yeah, you do have to work on components again of the biking, but, you know, a good bike fit goes a long way. And, you know, running, it's sort of like about durability, because we sort of are doing, we've got to teach ourselves to run with a lot of fatigue, and we want to be able to be, you know, be able to repeat that week after week, especially when we're doing Ironman races. So, yeah, so your run economy and your strength and being patient. I often tell my athletes, like, let the fitness come. You know, don't push it when you shouldn't push it. It's like, if you're starting from zero, it's like, let the fitness happen. And, you know, again, I mean, it's different when you're coaching an elite athlete and when you're coaching an age group athlete. When you're an elite athlete, there's a lot of things you can change, particularly if they've started very young. But you get a lot of these age groupers, and they have limitations, like physically, on what we can change. I mean, we can tell them to land a certain way. We can tell them that, you know, you've got to pick up your cadence. But it also depends on how they're built, and really, they've structurally, we can't make a lot of changes because that can then lead to energy, but injuries. But what we can do is work with that, those weaknesses, like typically for athletes, right? For triathlon, it's like glutes, hamstrings, calves, the Achilles, that whole chain is so important. So if we can make that stronger, then the running economy is going to come, and then giving them little cues that will fix some of the things that they can easily grasp onto, then that resilience and durability will come into play. So it's not as specific as just working on an energy system, which is important. But I think breaking it down on like, well, what are the weaknesses and strengths? Let's always work on those strengths. What weaknesses can we make better without losing sight that maybe we can't improve that as much as they think they can, and limiting that gap and using the energy towards facts that can make us a better athlete overall, if that makes sense.
Yeah, that makes sense. I mean, I think when an athlete has a strength in, let's say, one of the disciplines, that's typically because they have a higher level of natural talent, and having a higher level of natural talent basically means that they tend to be more responsive to further improve that discipline. So then that's something that you can lean into. And as you said, sometimes when you suck, you just suck. I mean, that's not
too... I hate to say that, but you know, it's true. It's like, you know, coming from a horse riding background, right? When you get on a horse, some people who get on a horse have this natural feel. They get it straight away. And then there's some athletes that get on a horse and they never have the ability to develop that feel. And it's sort of the same with triathlon. It's like, you know, some athletes just don't have the understanding, where other athletes, it comes a lot easier. And, you know, sometimes you can only change so much of someone. And I don't want them to, especially age group athletes, I don't want them to focus so much that, oh my God, I suck at this, and they get in their own head. So I think it's important that you've got to balance those parts out with, okay, I don't ever tell my athletes, you know, you suck at something, but it's like, hey,
of course,
let's like start like, and then that's where that mental game can come into, like, actually, you know what? I've come a long way. And a long way could be like anything for any athlete, right? Sometimes it's significant increase in your time that you can do in a 5K. Sometimes it's only like a couple of seconds. But I think really focusing on those strengths, then it sort of like takes a little bit away of that mental aspect of like, oh my God, I'm never going to get better, you know? So I think part of that philosophy, again, is that mental aspect of, hey, look, you're doing your best you can, reminding them that how far they have come. And it may be like baby steps, and it may be these big giant steps, but I don't like it when athletes focus too much on what they suck at, because it's detrimental to their performance, because they'll get in their own head at some point.
Yeah, and it's like you said earlier with that you have to enjoy what you're doing. If you are really, really focused on something that you perceive yourself as bad at, and you're also spending a lot of time doing that in your triathlon training, let's say to swim, because that's common for a lot of people, then that kind of takes a bit of the joy away from the training, versus if you have a really strong bike and you get to spend a lot of time further improving that bike, then that's almost like a self-fulfilling prophecy in a way, where you get that positive feedback loop of being allowed to do something that you're already pretty good at a lot, and you improve that even more. So that gives that positive vibes, basically, that you can also then leverage in the other sports, even, because you come to the pool feeling good and happy, because you don't have to do it 7 days a week. You're doing it maybe 3 days a week or 2 days a week, and you are able to focus on that when you do this.
And that sort of brings that philosophy is like, you don't always need to do more.
Yeah.
You know, and I think that's the mentality that you see. And I mean, it's a catch-22 now with the professionals who are on YouTube and telling us everything they're doing every single day, almost, it seems, right? And then like these age group athletes, like, well, why aren't I doing that workout? And, you know, it's that discussion that you got to have again. You know, it's like that may not be beneficial to you. It's like, what are you trying to achieve? You know, a professional athlete, they don't always like train a lot more. I mean, obviously they do a huge amount of training, but it's really the ability to rest after each session. You know, they're focusing 100% on their recovery. They're making sure they're doing all their functional stuff. They're making sure they're doing their activation. You know, it's all those pieces that they have a whole day to put together that a lot of age groupers don't. And, you know, you get a lot of age groupers that like might retire and all of a sudden they just like jam up the miles and they don't understand why they're not getting any faster. It's like, I always believe in everything in moderation. And I think I was lucky enough that from the beginning, my high school coach was very much get fast before you go long. And I've sort of kept that philosophy and, you know, and it sort of sometimes can stop burnout as well, because, you know, I see so many athletes that go out there and they do Ironman training week after week after week after week. And it's like, you don't need to ride that many hours week after week after week. It should be a very specific period when you are doing that Ironman prep. And I think Ironman athletes get caught out that they want to do all the training and they forget about racing. And, you know, I still believe, you know, those sprint distance races aren't for novice and beginners athletes. Like, that's pure speed. And yeah, like, I have these conversations probably every day with my Ironman athletes, but I don't like it. Yes, because it hurts to race short. And, you know, Ironman, you know, you do take, it hurts, like it's hard. You're putting a lot of hours in. And I think that's the hardest conversation that I have probably at the end of every year. Okay, time to let go that long stuff and let's go back to some shorter racing. And it will make you faster instead of like year after year, they just continue to do the same. I want to focus on Ironman. I want to focus on Ironman, which I get. But I think my role as a coach is like, hey, you're complaining that you're not like sort of like going anywhere. Well, these are some of the reasons why. And part of that is like, let's go back to some short course racing.
Yeah. So how do you structure that in a year? If somebody has, let's say they want to do an Ironman and you have some input in when they do that, would you then tell them to put the Ironman in the second half of the year sometime so they can go through and do some early spring and summer sprint distance, maybe some Olympic distance races? Is that how you would structure it, or what do you think?
Yeah, so yeah, definitely. Like, I'm like, I love the fact that like when I did my Ironman races, like I'm a speed demon. There's no doubt about it. So, and you know, a lot of times these athletes that love Ironman, they're big diesel engines. They can go all day long. And it's like they can never like sort of put their hand in the fire, so to speak, and really like push it to that anaerobic capacity as well. And, you know, to get to that, you know, to do some VO2 max work is sometimes really critical for those athletes. But they get caught up in like, it's, oh, but I have to do more than an hour session. I'm going, no, but it's an hour of quality. It's going to help you more than you possibly think. And one of the platforms I use is TriDot, and I love their philosophy of like, they're going to throw like some shorter intervals at you before they start focusing on the long. So in terms of where you would put those races, I mean, if you're going to generalize it, right, if you're training for Olympic, you should do some sprint racing. If you're training for a 70.3, you should do some sprint racing and definitely some Olympic distance racing. Because that's when nutrition starts to play a key role, is when you step up to that international Olympic distance. And then if you're doing an Ironman, yeah, you should be doing some 70.3s. And like, if we look at the world of the professional athletes and what happened this year, like let's go over like what happened, right? At the 70.3 worlds, the athletes that dominated were short course athletes. Unless you can't count Kat Matthews, because I think she's just a total freak and like, heck, absolutely like so consistent. But like, you see that speed that's coming from those Olympic distance, they're the ones that are dominating that 70.3 distance. And then when you look at the Ironman distance, the two athletes in Nice and Kona who focused 100% on their Ironman, they walked away with the Ironman World Championship titles. So I think it's important, like, Yeah, you got to pick your niche, but like it's also important to step away from that and put in some short course races. I mean, I used to do a bunch of sprint races before I did Ironman races. And Paula Nibia Fraser was always like, sorry about that, the dogs are barking in the background. Paula was always like, oh, Hakili, okay, I'll let you go race, but you've still got to do. But, you know, it was a nice way to keep in touch with what I love, but also it helped like keep that speed that I had developed over many, many years. And, you know, the philosophy is changing that, you know, you do have to do that short stuff. You have to work on every energy system, whether it's like 20-second sprints, whether it's like doing the threshold work above and below. And, you know, stay out of that gray area of zone three for sure. It's like, I think that's the biggest mistake that amateur athletes make, age groupers make. They don't know when to go easy, and then their hard is not much faster than their easy. And I think professionals like do a really good job of that. And, you know, the research is saying, you know, zone two is like super important. I mean, that's one thing Paula taught me from day one, slow down, chill out. And it's hard when you're coming from such a relationship. And so when you're putting in races, don't be afraid to step it down. Like, sprint distance racing is not just for novice athletes. You can put those races in and they're only going to help you get faster over those longer races. And I think one thing that the pros are really pushing the limits right now, they're going faster and faster. So, you know, when you look at a male athlete going 7 hours for an Ironman, you know, the amount of training that they're doing and the energy system, it is starting to shift. Yeah, it's still an Ironman distance, but you need to be fast. Like, there's no doubt about it that you've got to be able to push that lactate into a zone that you can maintain good power, say on the bike, that when you look at, like, when they're doing their lactic acid testing, it's like they can hold such a huge power at such a lower lactate number. And that's, I mean, they have to, because if you're going that fast, and the women, if you're going like 8 hours, it's the same thing. You've got to be able to find a way in your training. And I think that's where I believe the Norwegians have done a really good job, is making sure that they are going at the training, at the lactic level that they need to train at, and then not fatiguing them so much because they've gone way and above what that specifics of that training session is supposed to be. So, you know, doing the lactate testing when you're actually doing the workouts, I think, yeah, it's been around for a long time. I think people don't utilize that enough as an age grouper compared to what the pros. I mean, it's been around for a long time, but I think that's the big, when I look at, like, think about the Norwegian method, it's like, look, they're not going hard when they shouldn't be going hard. They're making sure they're sticking 100% after every interval in whatever capacity they're trying to achieve for that training session. So yeah, go out and race, and race some short races, because it's only going to help you.
Yeah, no, I completely agree with that. And I actually think when you talk about short course athletes dominating zone three worlds, I think it's just triathlon is becoming a mature sport, and the best athletes, the best triathletes are winning the big races. Even Patrick Lange, he has come from a kind of a short course background, not at the highest level, but he's done Bundesliga racing and so on.
Yeah.
He didn't get to go to the Olympics or anything, but he has gone through that school. And Laura Philipp is impressive because she's an exception to that. And same with,
yeah, there's Patrick. Always exception to the rules, yeah. Right? There's always exceptions.
And I mean, I think generally speaking, we can probably say that the women's racing is a little bit less deep than the men's. So probably in another 5 years, it will be even harder for somebody who hasn't gone through that kind of upbringing.
Yeah, I mean, I you know, it's funny because I look, so I don't always like to compare the men's racing to the women's racing, because I think it, for me, it stems down to a lot of stuff. You know, when you first have a kid, right, the way you treat a boy compared to a girl, like there's a whole political thing around it. But I think when you look at the women's race, there has been these, like, they really started the role of getting faster. It's like you saw it. It's like all of a sudden they were getting closer and closer to the men. And the men were sort of at a point. Now it's changed, right? It's starting to get better. But when you look at what's happening in that women's field and you compare, like, from the Olympics, which male athletes have succeeded, and then when you look at the women, which athletes have succeeded who are coming from that Olympic distance, there's less Olympic distance performance for women, right? Like someone like Emma Snowsill, right? Jan Frodeno's wife. I mean, she was a total badass at ITU. But, you know, it's like she didn't have, you know, the motivation perhaps. I've never had a discussion, but, you know, she had kids. I mean, it's changing now that if you want to have maternity leave, you're going to get paid for that. I think that's changing the process. And I think that's going to keep women in the sport longer, which is going to make it a little more competitive for sure. But it's like the performances, it's like the athletes that are doing ITU, not all of them are switching across to Ironman. And that's going to get less and less with the opportunities for sometimes these short course athletes to turn around and do races like the T100 and the 70.3 Worlds. You know, they're getting another, you're right, because the sport's growing. So there's more opportunities now. And even for the women, I think that maternity leave clause is huge. I think that's really going to benefit. And I think it's just a different style of racing. It's like that power to weight ratio can be so different in the men compared to the women. Like, you know, somebody who's going to ride the bike, like all those Uber bikers that we have in the men's field, we don't talk a lot about the Uber bike riders in the female because sometimes it's not as big as a spread. I mean, Taylor Nibb is like the exception to the rule, right? She's come in there and like she rides like a professional bike rider. And it's like, you know, she's changed it. So all the other women are going to start catching back up and it'll change. But we, you know, I think there was like a few Uber bikers there for a while. This is just an example, right? Where in the females, really, you got Taylor Nibb, who's like everyone will say she's the Uber bike rider. You know, she's just significantly faster on the bike. So in terms of competitiveness, and is it, I don't like to compare because I think the physiology of both the females and males are a little different and the capacity that they have to do certain things, like the explosive power, if you compare a male athlete to a female athlete, is very different. So I like to think that, you know, it is competitive. It's just competitive in a different way. I'd rather use that terminology than you know, it's not as competitive. I think it's competitive in a different way.
Yeah. I mean, I think at the top, it's just as competitive. And that was more of a sidebar just to say that I think that with the maturity of the sport today, you have to be like the level of athlete you have to be successful at any distance has just increased. And that's why, as you said,
the talent is fantastic. Yeah. I mean, that's why everyone's getting faster. You know, it's like triathlon's not easy. It's like there's a huge amount of time compared to like a single sport. But, you know, it's like the coaching has gotten better. The nutrition has gotten better. The equipment has gotten better. I mean, there's so many game changes that's making our sport, I think, even more attractive. The money's getting better, right? That's another game changer. So it is going to filter some of these athletes who maybe never thought about triathlon. You know, they're starting to think a lot more about it. And I think it's fantastic. I mean, I love the fact that our sport is so competitive and, you know, I get so excited when there's races coming up because I want to see what everyone's been up to. Like, well, who's your dark horse? Who's like, and you know, that's always fun, right? Especially when we're coming out of a winter season, like who got it right? Who didn't quite get it right? Right. We start to see that and we're like, well, who's on fire too early? I mean, I love Sam Long, but I think he sort of lives in that summer climate like all year around, you know what I mean? Like Arizona is like a beautiful climate. And I see it happen in Florida and Arizona that these athletes come out so strong at the beginning of the season and then it gets really hot and they can't maintain that form. And then everyone sort of starts getting into their form because, you know, they don't have the same weather restrictions. And I think the environmental factor is huge when you're coaching athletes. And especially when you're designing a program, because, you know, if my athlete I know like lives in Florida or Arizona, I'm going to be like, well, let's concentrate a little bit on the start of the season because I know that you're going to have like really good fitness just because of the environmental factors alone.
And would you then try to be more cautious about or more put more effort into having something like a mid-season break with that kind of athlete who has had the opportunity to work a bit harder maybe through the winter for some early season races?
Yeah, like last year was a typical example, right? Like if you had 70.3s, that was December, the middle of December. That's a long year. It's like, so yeah, so those little like pre-season breaks for me is so important. And some athletes might have like 4 or 6, depending on sort of what sort of schedule. But yeah, it's really important to schedule like not just those like cycles that you do through your periodic training, but like through the season, like taking a week off here or there. It's a real game changer, especially for age group athletes too, like making sure that they are mentally like hyped up and ready to go, like take some time out. You know, it's, you know, not, and it's, you know, it's the physical and the mental aspect of that recovery periods. It's like, and it's a time to refocus. Okay, we got that done. And I think one thing that's also underestimated is like when you athletes set out and they do these big, huge goals and they achieve them. And then, you know, that depression afterwards is real. You know, it's like, it's really hard to manage that. And it's like a lot of athletes, like you tell them it's going to happen. And then when it happens, they're like, oh, I didn't realize how bad it was going to be. And it's like, I always try to convince my athletes like, yeah, this is, you've been aiming for this goal sometimes for like 10 years, like to get to Kona. It's like, what's going to be your next after that? What is going to be your why? And it doesn't have to be a triathlon, but it has to be something because they've put so much time and energy into it. Often there's that big, huge depression that comes after it. And, you know, a lot of the professional athletes experience after big major comps and when they retire. I think one thing that I was lucky because I sort of feel like I never really retired, but you know, there was always a next. And for me, that was triathlon. And then of course, horse riding also helped with that. And I think, you know, it's important that you do find your next. And it doesn't, as I said, it doesn't have to be performance related, but there should be something after that big major goal that you've achieved.
Yeah. Yeah. I want to come back to a couple of points on the kind of high-end intensity training and what you discussed about not giving up your speed and losing that top end. So in practical terms, for training purposes, other than doing some shorter racing, but what in training, how do you advise athletes to basically work on that area of their physiology?
Yeah, so, I mean, it's part of like, you know, the sessions when you're creating that training plan. It's like, I'm not afraid to get my athletes to do like some 20-second sprints on the bike or even some 100 meters on the track, you know, just concentrating on good form. I mean, that's the most important thing, right? It's like, you don't want to injure your athlete by doing some of that top end. So my top end is short and sweet, right? Warm up well, do your pre-activation, make sure, you know, you increase that intensity and then you go to that higher intensity. And, you know, I think athletes have to understand that it doesn't have to be this huge session. For me, it's like it could be like you're doing like 6 20-second sprints with 2 minutes recovery, you know, a little bit more of that sprint mentality. And then, you know, in swimming, we tend to do it a little bit more because, you know, everyone loves sprinting for 25 meters, but even like sprinting for 12 and a half meters, you know, breaking it down so it's even shorter. And, you know, it's like some athletes, you know, need a little bit more. And that's where, you know, knowing your athlete, and some athletes like need a little bit less of that and you got to move them a little bit towards. But I think for me, it's like those sessions should be sharp and sweet and short. It's like, don't turn those speed demon sessions into a long session. And, you know, it's hard for these Ironman athletes to think that, hey, I only have to go out and do like 45 and 60 minutes and I'm done, when I'm so used to doing like 5 by 6 minutes or 18 by 1K. You know, it's like they get caught up in that philosophy. So, yeah, like even like running, it's like doing 7 by 20 seconds. And having then doing a cycle through that like 3 times with like a 40-second rest, and then have a 3-minute break and then do the next cycle. Like something like that, the leg speed that you create It's short and sweet. There's not a lot of stress that comes with your system because, you know, you're not doing a huge load of them and you're recovering. And then, yeah, it can make you sore the first couple of times, but, you know, it's sort of like a really good session to get a little bit of that reactive nature. And that's one thing that I love about like carbon plated shoes, right? It's like with the carbon plate and the foam density, it's like it's teaching, I don't care who you are, it's teaching you to get off a little bit quicker off the ground, right? And that's what we're all trying to do, that leg stiffness, getting off the ground as quick as we can. I mean, the Kenyans do it really well. It's like getting off that ground like really quickly. I mean, so anytime that you can like get athletes in those carbon plated shoes, as long as the, you know, there's been a phase leading up to it and they're in the right type of carbon plate with the right foam and doing some of that quick stuff, I think it's such an advantage because, I mean, that's what I love about those carbon plated shoes, right? You recover quicker, you can do better quality sessions and, you know, you're going faster at the same heart rate, basically. So I think, you know, just adding some of that, even that sprint mentality. And then, of course, those VO2 max efforts are really important. And, you know, it doesn't have to be a straight 8-minute effort. It could be 40 seconds hard in that VO2 max, or it could, and 20 seconds easy, and you do that for the whole 8 minutes. So you're motivating the athlete. They're going to push themselves a little bit more, but they're really getting the quality. And especially if you're staying in those VO2 max ranges, then you're pushing that lactic acid. You're like expanding their ability to go faster and easier when they need to go at that race pace.
And do you tend to how do you periodize the type of sprint sessions and the VO2 max sessions that you described? Is that something that you tend to do earlier in the year, at like a reverse periodization, or do you, all year
no,
round?
No, like all year round. And, you know, yeah, you can spread it out like maybe like 6 to 8 weeks. You know, obviously when you're in a specific race phase, there's certain things that you have to do. But sometimes like when I'm doing like some of my threshold testing, it's like it'll sort of be in the recovery weeks because it, like for me, the threshold testing is like a 5K run. It's a 200 and a 400 swim and then, you know, a 20-minute test for the FTP. So it's like sometimes scheduling those in as well is really beneficial as well. But yeah, like every 6 to 8 weeks, hey, let's do something fun. And it can even be like a tri workout where you go swim like 200 meters, you ride the bike for 5K, you get off and run a K. You know, doing those short, sharp, especially and refining your skills because you've got to also then work on transitions, which is one of the most underrated skill that I think anyone ever does. I'm a big believer in that little skill development can like go a long way because, you know, those transition skills aren't just about getting faster at transitions. It's building a relationship with the bike as well and a relationship to the physiological changes that you need from the swim to the bike and the run as well. So yeah, like I think we sometimes get stagnated in like we've got to train on this system because that's the system we're going to be using in our race. And it's like it's always nice to go, hey, and I think it's motivating for the athletes too. Make it short and sweet.
Yeah, yeah. And the other question, follow-up question on that was you mentioned that you are a speed demon. So yeah. I'm wondering how you... like athlete profiling, speed demons and diesel engines, is that something that you, how do you adapt training to different athlete profiles like that? Are there some key considerations that you would change if you coach one type of profile versus the other?
Well, you know, being an older athlete, we have to be a little bit more careful. I definitely, like for me personally, I've got to pick and choose. Like I sort of like, I have to sort of stay a little bit under what that full speed would be because I know then the risk of injury. I've learned over the years, it's like when I'm feeling good and I want to push it, just don't do it. And I sort of tell my athletes that as well because you want to save that little bit sometimes for racing as well. And that's why, you know, just keeping it a little bit shorter sometimes, as long as you've had a good warm up and as long as you're not, you're letting the fitness come, right? If you try to run 22nd as hard as you can and you haven't done the right prep to actually do that and you're thinking that you're still like 20 years old when you're like 50 years old, that's going to create issues. So, but you know, when you're profiling an athlete, just ask them, you'll know straight away. Okay, do you want to do 7 by 20 seconds or do you want to do 7 by 7 minutes? Straight away, you're going to know what type of athlete that they are because they're going to choose the one that they like enjoy the most. So like sort of flip-flopping that sometimes is sometimes that, you know, I'll do that with my athletes. But yeah, so it's like when you're profiling them, it's like obviously we know that they're good at a certain like ability. Some athletes aren't, right? Some athletes, you got to teach them everything. But yeah, it's just a matter of like going in, asking that one question, and you will figure out straight away whether your athlete's a speed demon or a big diesel engine. And, you know, as I said, then there's like, it's never like straightforward like that, but that's a good starting point because they're going to tell you straight away. Like if they want to go and run an ultra, you know, they're a, or an Ironman and they love doing the long workouts. Like me for a speed demon, I'm going to be like, I'm happy to go and run like an hour and do my intervals and be done. You know, get out on the bike, you know, even an hour on the bike, quite happy to get out and do that. And it's like each one has purpose and it's just making sure you're working on all the energy systems. I think that's, even if you are an Ironman athlete or a sprint distance athlete, you know, those energy systems have a purpose. It's like when you break down a triathlon, it's like we always talk about like in an Ironman, like don't burn the matches, right? And a sprint triathlon, we're going to be burning a few matches because we can. So it's like it's still at some point you may have to burn some matches. Like if you're in an Ironman race and you get stuck in the draft zone, you may have to burn some matches. So I think it's important as a coach to work on some of those parts of that, that yeah, maybe they're not the general philosophy of how the race should go, but they happen. So that's why I think, you know, energy systems have purpose. And I think it's important that you do get your athletes to do different energy systems, ensure they're a well-rounded athlete. And, you know, it creates variety. It's going to stop the burnout for one. So if you can do that, I mean, that I think the biggest thing that athletes have, and we don't see sometimes a longevity, is that overtraining and burnout and not being adaptable, particularly when you're an age grouper.
Yeah, no, that makes sense. And coming back to that thing that I alluded to in the beginning about your education background and how you use that in your coaching, do you have some, yeah, can you give some examples of how you benefit from that in, yeah, whether it's in communication or how you design sessions or whatever it might
yeah,
be?
Yeah, for sure. Yeah, so I think the philosophy of how, my perfect philosophy is, I sort of bring it back to how kids learn math, right? When kids learn math, some kids can like go through the process, but there's a sort of a process that you have to go through in order to get to the next process. And it's a little bit like I ride dressage and it's the same sort of thing. If you don't do this level, you'll never get to this level to get to, there's no skipping. So in terms of that, it's like the teaching philosophy that has taught me. So when I have an athlete, it's like some athletes, we need to spend more time in first grade, right? Some athletes, they'll get to like 12th grade really quickly. And that's, I think, how I really like use my teaching probably more than anything else, is that ability to like identify where an athlete is, what they need to do and where they need to go. And, you know, it sounds very simple, but, you know, it's an important component because you have to understand, like, you know, some athletes just are so data driven and some athletes are not so data driven, right? It's like, that's just the way it is. So, you know, it's like, again, it's that adaptability. It's just like in teaching, right? One strategy may not work for each kid. And it's the same thing when you're coaching. That one strategy may not work. And one thing that I always do at the end of the year, I'm like, I analyze, well, what if this is the type of athlete that I'm attracting? What do they think that I'm going to give them that maybe another coach can't give? And then how can I improve what I want to do with my coaching? Like, what's the type of athlete that I want to coach? Number one is always coachable, right? Because a lot of times you'll get athletes that like come into a system and they're so used to one thing, it's hard to adapt. And you've got to like maybe be a little bit slower on the adaption process with them rather than someone's going, I want to change everything. And I'm like, whoa, whoa, whoa. We maybe don't want to change anything. Like, what are some things that you think give you the biggest bang for your buck? So again, it's like that teaching style that I think I learned of making sure that, you know, and I think I did this really well as a professional, right? I could get on a race course and straight away analyze the strengths and weaknesses of a lot of the athletes. So I may not have been always the talented athlete out there, but I definitely knew how to get in people's head physically or mentally just by learning their strengths and their weaknesses. And I think that's the same in coaching, right? You've got to get into their head and work out what makes them tick. What can I do? Sometimes I've got to push them harder. Sometimes you've got to be a little bit more supportive, you know? So it's like, it's really like, well, who is this athlete? How can I be a better coach by understanding them?
Can you give some examples, broad brush strokes of what are the type of concepts, let's say, that you talk about with somebody coming in at first grade versus somebody who is a bit more advanced at fifth grade versus somebody who is about to graduate 12th grade? So a little bit of what are the very early and most important fundamental concepts, some things that are in the middle and some things that are kind of at the most advanced end.
Well, here's good two scenarios. So I had an athlete that came in that had imposter syndrome, right? It's like they never believed they were good enough to do anything, even though they would show up to every single training session. And, you know, that's half the battle there, right? Showing up, right? But like getting them to believe that they should be on the start line. And, you know, it sort of happened the last couple of years with the extra slots for women for the Ironman World Championships. You know, there was a lot of women that, you know, got slots that probably, you know, back in the day would never have got them because it was so hard. Like I would have age group athletes that would win their age group, and that's the only way they could get a spot. You know, they'd get second and they would never get a spot. So you had this one particular athlete, like, it's like, she did fairly well in her race. And I'm like, just go to the roll down. Just go to the roll down. You never know. And it's like, no, I don't think I should go. It's like, you know, I didn't get an automatic. I don't think I deserve to be there. It's like, you know, and it's changing that philosophy around of like, as I said, you know, you show up to every session. Like, you deserve to be there. It's like, oh, and then it's like, I don't think I can do it. I'm like, you've done it before. You know, you had to do an Ironman to get to that world championship. So for that particular athlete, it wasn't so much the physical, it was the mental side. And it was just like, you know, just show up and do the workouts. And then, you know, they would come to some of the workouts and literally they wanted to go home. I go, you're already out here. Oh, but everyone's faster than me. And I think that's an important coaching moment too. It's like, you're not racing against anyone else. You're racing against yourself. It's like, again, I think Paul and Yubi Fraser taught me this well. Always take the pressure off. And I try to do that in coaching. Like, I see athletes that come in and they like to put so much pressure on themselves. Like, chill out, relax. Because it's funny because, you know, we've talked a lot about the mental process, but I think it's a huge component of being successful as a coach, because everyone trains hard. It's like the details are really what matter. And I try to teach that to my athletes. And the details could be, you know, your nutrition. It could be your activation. It could be, you know, a strength in some way. So yeah, like for her, it was like, you're not an imposter. You deserve to be here. Yeah. You don't think you are, but here's the reasons why you should believe. And, you know, she ended up doing really good at the world championships. Like, she was afraid that she was going to get dead last. And I'm like, trust me, it's okay. Just focus on you. And then I had another athlete, very, very athletic, but couldn't take their hands off the handlebars. So again, physically could do all the workouts, but then struggled with those basic skills. And like, so for someone like that, you've got to break it down and just go completely back to skills. You know, it's like, let's build that relationship with the bike. Let's get you so that you can descend safely, that you can, you know how to corner, you know how to get, if you are in a situation, you know how to get yourself out, you know how the brakes work, you know, you can take your hands off, you know, you teach them those skills. So two different, one was sort of like, even though it was a mental block with not being able to take the hands off the handlebars, that was a physical skill that we could develop. And then on the other hand, it was basically a mental skill that we needed to change and develop.
Yeah. So, and it's about maybe, yeah, not getting ahead of yourself and focusing on some fancy workouts or nutrition strategies before you have solved some more fundamental things that are, yeah, at a more basic level or more, yeah, more fundamental with that mental limitation with the imposter syndrome case and then the physical skill of being able to be comfortable riding, even taking the hands off the handlebars.
And I think like a lot of young athletes these days are so used to like instant gratification that they're not prepared always to put the hard work in. And I don't know, this is just my own like personal philosophy, but I have this 7-year rule. When you see an athlete come into the sport, it doesn't matter if it's a professional athlete or an age group athlete, it's like you watch that 7-year progression. And when they get to that year 7, you will see that the athlete's ability right there. What's their maximum potential is after that 7 years of steady progression. So if you go back and you look at some athletes who have raced, even professional athletes, and you count how many years they've been racing, and all of a sudden they have this standout performance, usually it's like around that 7 mark. No research but my own like says that, but like I hope your listeners like take a good look at that and realize that, you know, triathlon is hard. You got to be consistent and be consistent. And some people, yeah, are always going to have more success early, but you know, it's a commitment. And I think remember that commitment should be long term because triathlon is a lifestyle, but like don't go all in straight away. You know, there's got to be a progression. And I think people like tend to want to get the reward so quickly, but definitely there's a better reward waiting if you are a little bit more patient.
Yeah, absolutely. I've heard that. I've heard 7, I've heard 10. I would agree that it's in that range for sure. So definitely a game of patience. Let's see here. We've skipped a bit through our list of questions. So I'm just trying to, but we've had lots of other questions that are not on here. And one that I really wanted to ask was how coaches you've had have influenced your coaching. You've already mentioned a lot of great tips that you got from Paula Newby-Fraser, but is there anything that you haven't mentioned that stands out in addition to the things that you already said about advice that you've had from her or from any other coaches that you've had in the past?
Yeah, like obviously my first run coach like really enforced that speed element. And then I had a swim coach that was like every Friday we would have to do 16 400s in the pool on the 5.5 in a 50-meter pool. And the warm-up, he said, was turning the heater on in the car, right? So when you're doing it, like you don't really think about what you're taking away. But, you know, what he taught you is like consistency, boring, right? Sometimes workouts are boring and you just got to get it done, right? It's like old school philosophy, right? But it still has a place, I feel. But yeah, every Friday, 16 400. So, but yeah, like that old school coaching mentality for swimming, like definitely it was there. And then, you know, I actually had a Pacific run coach who was an 800-meter silver medalist. And I think I taught him a few things, but he definitely taught me a few things. But one thing that he'd always say, oh, you know, swimming's just for recovery. It's so easy. And I'm like, dude, come and do some of our swim sessions. So, you know, it's that relationship that you're building with the coach that, you know, back then too, you know, you got to have a good understanding, because I think still Pacific individual coaches can play a huge role even to this day. And it was just teaching him that, you know what, you need to be adaptable to what the demands of triathlon are, because obviously the demands of running at 800 and running fast, like, you have that down. It's like, but, you know, your coach has to understand the demands of the competition, right? And then, you know, you have coaches that, I've had coaches that, you know, are very, like, even when I was at the Olympics, it was like, I brought him into Sydney and the night before the race, he's like, McKeely, you need to go to bed. I'm like, dude, I'm like 32 years old. I think I know when I can go to bed. But, you know, it's like, it's just like, sometimes micromanaging isn't for everyone, right? It's like when I used to go and swim with all the age group kids, and then that coach would then coach like our master's age group, like the older kids. The philosophy that they use for those, obviously kids need more direction and more micromanaging. And, you know, as older adults, it's not that we need to get told usually to do something, because we're all like competitive and push ourselves. A lot of the times as a coach, you have to hold that athlete back. So I've had a few coaches that have been like, no, you've got to do this workout, like running into the change room. And I'm like, no, I'm done. And they're chasing me into the women's change room. And I'm like, no, you don't understand. I know I'm done. It's like, there's a point where, you know, it's not that you're trying to get out of a workout. You just know it's not going to be detrimental to your performance. So yeah, it's just for me, like the coaches I think that I work well is that have that collaboration. Like when I was doing the para triathlon, the Australian para coach, he was really good. Like after a race, hey, McKeely, what do you think we should do to make this athlete better? Because he knew that I was with her every minute of the race. And so that was like, you know, a good collaboration, because he's like, well, McKeely, what do you think we can do? And I think that's what a good coach does, right? They build a good team around them. They know their strengths and their weaknesses. And like, even when I was racing, I had a good team around me that would help me. And I did the same with my coaching. Like, I know that I have my limitations, and I know certain aspects of the coaching, I want them to get the best possible advice from experts. And it's like, I don't know everything. What I do know, I know. And what I don't know, I use other people for. And I think that's important, a big important thing as a coach.
I mean, as a coach, you need to, one of the things you need to do is to identify your athlete's strengths and weaknesses, right? So, but if you need to do that, then you'd better be able to identify your own strengths and weaknesses as well. Isn't it that simple?
Yeah.
Those are some great stories and great takeaways. One other a bit different topic here, specifically for age group athletes of different, let's say, profiles. First of all, time crunched age group athletes. Can you give one few general pieces of advice for time crunched age group athletes?
Look, you only have the amount of time that you have, and I know like motivated athletes are always gonna create and do everything that you put in front of them. They just manage to do it. And then you have athletes that, this is all I have. And that's okay. It's like, you make the most of what you have. It's like, don't think that, oh my goodness, so-and-so's doing this. You can't control that. It's like, you can only control the amount of time that, one, you're willing to put in it, two, that you even have allocated, but make the most of that. If I always tell my athletes, look, 0 minutes is valued at nothing. 1 minute has a value. And I think that's important. Like, make the most. If you only have 30 minutes, go and do a 30-minute workout. And yeah, like adding a little bit more intensity to that is going to be more beneficial. But yeah, like 0 minutes does nothing. 1+ minutes it's doing something. So I think that's, for a time crunch athlete, my biggest advice is, if your schedule says 60 minutes and you only have 30 minutes, get 30 minutes done.
Yeah, great. What about older athletes, let's say 50 plus?
Like me?
Yeah.
You know, it's like, I think being an older athlete has its advantages, right? Because, you know, if you look at an athlete who's coming into the sport later in life, I mean, their neurons are fresh, right? So they're lucky. Someone like me who's been in the sport for a long time, my neurons are not fresh. You know, I have to pick and choose wisely. So it's like for anyone, right? It's like when you want to go fast or you want to push a little bit harder, don't do it. As an older athlete, save it for the races, because I know every time I'm like, oh, I'm feeling good, I'm like, you know, blah, 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 and I just push over the edge, it's like always the worst case scenario. It's like, oh, I always hurt myself. So it's like, you know, take a step back. If you've been in the sport for a long time, it's like you have a lot of endurance. You have a lot of muscle memory. It's basically picking and choosing. So pick wisely. If you're older and newer to the sport, obviously you're fresher. So you actually are going to, you know, have big improvements compared to more that seasoned athletes. But, you know, don't be afraid to like race within yourself, in your training especially. It's like, yeah, it's like just be careful. It's like you don't want to get injured. You don't want to get sick. You know, you don't want to be dealing with those things that have a negative impact on your performance. So, yeah, my biggest advice to older athletes like me is, and I tell my athletes this all the time, it's like, when you're feeling good and you want to push yourself in training, just don't do it. Like, be patient. Just dial it back a little bit. And Paul and Yubi Fraser always used to be, tell me, the speed will be there when you need it. Like, sometimes you got to let go. As much as I love doing like some shorter workouts, definitely sometimes I've just got to let it go.
Yeah. And the final category here, athletes that are kind of just starting out in triathlon, and who might be a bit overwhelmed about everything that's going on and don't really know where to start and, yeah, where to go.
As I said, a good coach is investing in yourself. Definitely, if you can afford that, that's definitely one thing you should, because they're going to make sure that you're on the right path and not making mistakes that potentially you would make yourself. But, yeah. Like, number one, find your why. And don't get put off if you have obstacles in the way. It's like, it's not a straight path. It's curved. There's always challenges. And I think a lot of people, it's like, I think it's awesome that they commit to something, but there's not always that follow through. And I think that's why you have to keep reminding yourself, well, why I did this, when even though this person may be around me may be negative, no, I want to stay true, because there's nothing better than crossing that finish line and going, oh my goodness, I didn't think this was possible, but I did it. And I think that's what's the allure of any finish line, but particularly an Ironman finish line. Like, I've raced every single finish line imaginable, right? From the Olympics to the Ironman. And it's like, there is really nothing like that finish line at an Ironman. It's emotional, it's empowering, and, you know, it's the journey that's worth it. You know, it's if it was going to be easy, then everyone would do it. So for anyone starting out, remember your why and get to that finish line, because anything that is a little difficult and, you know, you've got to struggle through, you're going to teach yourself a lot about yourself, and it's so worth it in the end. So stick with it.
Yeah. And for age group athletes, continuing on that theme, are there some, let's say, concepts or, let's leave it at concepts as a high-level term, that within the current triathlon landscape that you would consider overrated and underrated, if you can give a couple of examples of each?
I think in terms of what's overrated is there's no quick fixes. I mean, we talked a little bit about this, you know, it's consistency over time. And I think, you know, there's really no quick fixes
on that. Can you give some specific example of something that has been, let's say, that your athletes have thought are maybe quick fixes, or that you've seen marketed as quick fixes, anything like that?
Yeah, like, I mean, I talk a lot about free speed, right? But you really can't buy free speed. You've still got to put the work in. You can enhance that free speed. Like, you know, I've had like this one particular athlete that was like, oh, I want to do this, like big, huge goals. And everything she sees the pros using, she will buy and he will buy. And I'm like, yeah, that's going to help you to a point. But basically, there's no piece of equipment that you're going to buy that is going to be more significant than getting out there and putting in your time. And yeah, I think that's a big one that I see a lot. It's like, you know, I just got this fancy aero helmet. I just got this fancy bike. It's like, yeah, you know, details do matter for sure. Like when I was getting ready for 70.3 World Championships, I'm like, I'm going to do everything possible. It doesn't matter if there's no benefit, but if I believe it's going to be a benefit, then it's going to, but I put the hard work in. And I think that's like really important. It's like, yeah, we can get free speed, so to speak, from buying it, but ultimately you got to put the hard yards in. Yeah. So I see that a lot for sure. And I think the other thing that I think is like underrated is racing. It's like, I think as an age group athlete, it's like a lot of athletes get stuck in just doing that one Ironman race. And they're like, I've got to go and do my long run. I've got to go do my long ride. Don't underestimate the power of racing, for sure. I mean, it's like, you know, it's like go, it's like a truth serum, right? When you go to race, it's going to tell you exactly what you did well, what you did badly. And I preach this all the time. It's like, be the happy with the race you had rather than the race you wished you had. And I think, you know, things, there's a couple of like nutrition. It's like, there's all sorts of nutrition fads out there. You know, it's like, but for me, my biggest advice is, yeah, it's good to research and know what the latest trend is, but ultimately, everything in moderation is how I live my life by nutritionally. It's like too much of one thing is bad. Not enough of one thing is bad as well. So that moderation piece, it's like when I'm doing basic nutrition for my athletes, just everyday nutrition, I'm like, look at your plate. Make sure it's colorful. Make sure the protein that you have on the plot on your plate is appropriate to the type of workout that you do. And carbohydrates are fuel. Like you are like a car. It's like if you don't put fuel in the car, you're going to get injured and not be able to have the energy to do your workouts. And, you know, those fats and those oils have purpose. And, you know, protein has purpose. So I think, you know, it's the same thing. It's like, don't be stuck on too many supplements. Like, have like good colorful plates. I think that's like really important as well. And if I was going to think of another fad that I've seen lately, I mean, I think it's more, you know, we can learn a lot from the professionals, but we're not professionals, right? The ability, especially in bike fit, I see this all the time. Like my athletes come to me and they're like, I want to be narrow and I want to be this. And I'm like, look, physically, you're not capable of that. It's like, let's look at what the pros are doing, because ultimately they're going the fastest that any athlete's ever gone is the professionals. So yeah, let's use what they're doing that best suits who you are, not what it's, it may not suit everyone. So I think that's super important advice too. Yeah, we can learn a lot from the pros, but it's not always adaptable to you as you.
Yeah, absolutely agreed. And let's finish off with some reflective questions. So first of all, is there something that you're trying to learn more about or are focusing on at the moment or recently?
Well, you never stop learning, that's for sure. And I've been lucky enough to be working with on the Ironman U certification coaching platform at the moment. So, you know, it's one of those things that I like to keep learning. Although, you know, I've I often tell my athletes, I've been in the sport for a long time. If it hasn't happened to me, it'll probably never happen to you. But yeah, I think it's important for me to keep my education ahead of the curve. One of my favorite sayings from a certain professional cyclist is always act like you are behind. And yep. I think that's it. And it's the same with coaching, right? I want to make sure that, you know, I'm ahead of the curve, that I'm ahead of everyone else, that the information that I'm providing you is like going to ensure that you have an advantage over every other competitor that you're racing with. So, yeah, so education for me is like super important. And of course, that probably comes from my teaching degree as well.
Yeah, of course. And is there a specific topic that has been particularly interesting for you recently that you have been researching?
Well, you know, it's like we talked about the Norwegian method a little bit. And it's like when I see that sort of stuff, I like to break it down because it's like, well, what exactly can we use as part of that to make us better? And, you know, as I said, you know, it's like, it sometimes will work for some athletes. It sometimes won't work from athletes. But I think there's, for me, the Norwegian method is like, there's a lot of hype, but it's really the basics. You know, it's making sure you're doing the right type of training and going at the intensity that you need to ensure that you're getting the quality and the recovery that you need from those workouts. I mean, to me, that's breaking it down very simply. Basically, that's what it should be, right? We're all trying to get better. How can we do that in a way that isn't overhyped?
Yeah. And what is the best or most influential book that you've read?
Oh, that's a tricky one. Actually, can we change that a little bit? Because I just listened to this awesome podcast called The Girl Who Fell Out of the Sky.
Yeah.
And it really like motivated me. I don't want to tell too much of the story, but it's basically about a young Australian girl who went jumped out of an aeroplane.
Parachuting?
To do parachuting. Yeah. And it's just like, it's all about attitude, right? I think I sort of enjoy those type of books.
And that, like those is this the name of
like
the book?
Like an autobiography.
Is this the name of a podcast or the name of a podcast episode?
It's a podcast episode. If you just Google The Girl Who Fell Out of the Sky,
right?
It's like a really interesting story. And it's like, I mean, I love those personal stories. So if I'm going to read a book, I love a good autobiography.
Yeah.
It's like, I love that. There's a movie that just came out about Alina Dokic, and she's an Australian tennis player. They haven't released it internationally. But again, it's like you never know what the backside to what's happening in closed doors, right? And I think that's another powering story. If anyone ever gets to see that, hopefully it'll be a success and it goes to internationals. But right now it's just screening in Australia. But yeah, like for me, like a good autobiography, and it doesn't have to be like something tragic that happened. I just find it really interesting because sometimes when you're like reading or listening to a good story or watching a good story, it's like, it's not always the same path that everyone's on, but eventually they do meet up. And I think that's the type of book that I really enjoy.
Yeah. Oh, you can definitely learn a lot. For example, I think Chrissy Wellington's autobiography is for me, one of the most influential books that I've read.
Yeah, you know, exactly. It's like, you know, Chrissy came on the scene. She wasn't on the scene for very long, but she was an influencer. She changed the whole dynamics of Ironman. And I that's the thing. I think there's been a few pinnacle people in our sport that have really been game changers. And it's great because it challenges everyone to go to the next level.
Yeah. And finally, what is the best advice that you've ever received?
What's the best advice that I've ever received? Well, my twin sister My twin sister always used to say, you're unmotivated is somebody else's motivated.
You're unmotivated is somebody else's motivated. Right, yeah. Yeah, getting it now.
Yeah. And I think like the other advice I ever got was like, well, it's sort of advice because my first run coach, we'd been running around like this grass field and he'd always would say, will you remember me when you're famous? And at the time, you don't realize what good advice that is, right? But basically it's like, stay humble. And I think triathlon is the most humbling sport in the world. It's like, it'll always turn around and kick you in the butt. So at the point when he was saying that, I'd sort of giggle and laugh because, you know, I was like a teenager. But now I like realize what a powerful message that is.
Yeah.
That, yep. You know, being true to yourself, true to your roots, you know, all those sort of things. And I think I've kept myself pretty grounded. And I think that's one of the reasons why, like, I've been very consistent over the years is, hey, look, at the end of the day, triathletes, we're all crazy. We're all like, you know, there's all these issues that we have, and triathlon's a little bit probably like our therapy. But at the end of the day, like, I think being grounded and like appreciating everything that you do, like I said earlier, be happy with the race you had, not the race you wished you had. Just living by that myself is like really made triathlon like a longevity thing. And it is fun, even though it's hard and there's moments where it's like, oh my goodness, why the hell am I doing this? It's like, there's a lot of moments where it's like, look how lucky I have been. This sport has given me so much.
That's a great note to end on, I think. Although before we do that, of course, please let us know where we can follow you. And I heard that there is a chance to listen to you now, perhaps on a new podcast venture.
Yeah, it just launched our first episode called The Giddy Up Edge, Conversations on Getting Faster. So you can find that on most of the podcast platforms, of course, Apple. And then, you know, online. On Facebook, social media. I have a website, giddyupmultisports.com. You can also catch me on Instagram and Facebook as well. So, yeah, love to hear from you. This has been absolutely fantastic. I was so excited when you asked me to be on the show. So thank you very much.
Yeah, thank you, Michaela. I really enjoyed this chat and I hope to do it again another time.
Thank you.
I hope that you enjoyed that interview. As you can imagine, if I ever make a That Triathlon Show blooper reel, you will for sure have my mispronunciation of Michaela's name in there. I was a bit embarrassed about that, I have to say, but it was a good lesson to not assume but confirm, so I'll take that as a positive. As always, you can find the show notes for this episode on scientifictriathlon.com. Again, a reminder to those of you, especially the ones who are newer to the podcast, the show notes are detailed. It's like an article, an in-depth article that goes through pretty much all of what was said in the podcast, but it's in something that can be read in more like 5 to 10 minutes. So it's not a short 1 minute listicle, but it's also not a full transcript of the interview, which probably makes no sense to read because then you might as well listen. So it's something in between, something detailed, but a bit more bite-sized than a 90-minute interview. So check out the show notes. We do them for all of the episodes. And they're really well-received. If you haven't checked them out, then that's worth doing on scientifictriathlon.com. Now, before closing out today's episode, this is probably the final reminder that you can register for one of our training camps coming up very soon. We have the first one in Mallorca in early April, and then we are in the Algarve in Portugal at the very end of April and early May. So these camps are very well attended already, but they are not 100% full. So there are slots available to both of these if you are interested and you are able to sign up and come to these camps or one of these camps on a short notice. You can read more about them on scientifictriathlon.com and you can email me if you have questions and want to learn more. But to summarize, very briefly, what's so great about training camps, or some of the main points anyway, not all of the points. In my opinion, it boils down to how fun it is and what a great fitness boost you get when you're able to train full-time for a week and you're basically, when you're not training, you're basically resting and recovering or eating. But you're doing that in a group with great camaraderie. We've always had great groups on our camp, so that one I'm very confident that we can deliver also for this year. And you also do that while exploring a new destination or an old destination that you love and you just want to return to time and time again, which is certainly the case for us with Mallorca. There are many other reasons to join a camp, but I think the essence of it is this good old-fashioned training in a great environment with great people. That's what makes a camp great, and you will for sure get that at either one of our camps. But again, you can find more information about the camps on scientifictriathlon.com or scientifictriathlon.com/Mallorca, scientifictriathlon.com/Portugal for the respective camps if you want to go directly to those URLs. And if you have any questions, please email me and I'll be happy to help. Finally, big thanks to our sponsors, Precision Fuel and Hydration, that you can find on precisionfuelandhydration.com. If you're looking for high-quality, practical, and tasty fueling and hydration products, make sure to try Precision Fuel and Hydration. Don't forget to take 15% off your first order with the code TTS25. And thank you, as always, for listening. Keep training smart and keep loving triathlon.